Broadcasting.
Good morning. It's April 20th, 2021, and I call the House Committee on Revenue to order. Will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Levy?
Present by video and glad to say I'm in the Capitol.
Representative Marsh?
Marsh is here by video.
Representative Smith?
Representative Smith's here by video. Mr. Chair, at 9 a.m., I have to step out for another commitment, but then I'll jump on.
Understood. Thank you.
Representative Valderrama?
Valderrama present by phone.
Vice Chair Pham?
Pham is present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke?
Reschke present by video.
And Madam Chair Nathanson is excused.
Excused. All right, we have a quorum. Today in front of us, we have a public hearing on two bills and a work session for discussion only on two bills. So I will open a public hearing on House Senate Bill 136. LRO, would you give us a, I believe you have a presentation.
Yes, thank you, Chair Reschke. This is Caitlin Harder from the Legislative Revenue Office, and I will share my screen as I go through some background information on interstate broadcasters. So before you today is Senate Bill 136A, passed out of the Senate committee and the Senate floor. And so I'll go through the kind of the background related to this topic, because the taxation policies can be pretty complicated at times. And then towards the end of the presentation, I'll outline the changes that have been made in the bill. So a quick review of terms related to corporate taxation that I wanted to present here. And also, of course, the slideshow is in OLIS for anyone that needs to look back at it later. Nexus is the first term, and this refers to whether or not a state can tax a corporation. So if the corporation has a business connection to the state, often this will be referred to as having nexus, then the state can subject the company to the state's income taxes. So one of the big questions around the broadcaster bill in previous sessions and previous studies that we've done on this is around how nexus is established in this industry. The second key term here is apportionment. And apportionment is a method that's used to calculate what percent of federal income a state can tax. So if you think about a corporation that's operating in multiple states, even if we just consider a corporation that's operating in Oregon and Washington, and let's say that that corporation made $1 million in income that year. The question of apportionment looks at, okay, if I'm, as a state, Oregon, how do we determine what portion of that $1 million Oregon gets to tax? And how would Washington determine what portion of that $1 million that Washington gets to tax? And so using apportionment, we calculate, or the state calculates, a percentage of federal income that that state can tax. And to do this, we have two kind of sub-definitions here. The first is federal taxable income, and that's the amount of income subject to income tax within the United States. And state taxable income, and that's the amount of income subject to tax within a state. And so this would be the amount of income that's left after apportionment. So from apportionment, the kind of the natural next question is how do states apportion that percentage? And Oregon currently uses what's called a single sales factor calculation for apportionment. So for apportionment, if you look at the very last bullet point here, remember, the concept of apportionment is to take federal taxable income and share it to the states. So we're going to take federal taxable income and multiply what's called our single sales factor, which is our apportionment ratio. And that is the amount of Oregon sales relative to U.S. sales for this company. So notice there's a difference here. The sales factor, which is what we use to apportion, is based on sales. And we apply that sales factor to federal taxable income. So we're taking a measure of how many sales took place in Oregon relative to the rest of the country and using that amount to share down income. And that gives us our Oregon taxable income. So just kind of a quick refresher there and a quick overview for our new member to talk about these three main terms. And again, this is all available in OLIS. I know it can be a lot of information at first. Briefly, I'll talk through an industry description. This is a graphic that LRO produced as part of the research report on the interstate broadcasters that I believe was finalized in 2019, which feels like a very long time ago now. So the way the industry is currently set up, we view this as kind of like three channels of production. The first being the content production. So the things that you watch or listen to, this is the stage where those things are produced. The second stage being distribution. So how the things that are produced get to you. And then the final piece being the end users. So how are you actually watching the content or viewing or listening to the content? So in terms of content production in today's market, we've separated this column into kind of three different categories: national networks, cable networks, and consumer direct. And going first to national networks, these are the this would be ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox. And these are the national networks that have been, the name of national networks stems from when these were the dominant networks for television back in, these were the dominant for television. I don't know the exact year, but prior to cable being widespread, these were the four networks that provided a lot of content to American households. And then cable networks are the channels that you're familiar with that you can access through a traditional cable subscription. So for example, things like the Cartoon Network or MTV or the Weather Channel. So any channel that you would need to traditionally have a cable bill in order to access, that would be a cable network. And then consumer direct is any content production that's provided directly to the viewer. Typically, this is done in internet distribution, which I'll talk about in a second. But in terms of content production, these three categories are all capable of producing original content for viewers. So once that content is produced, we move to the distribution section of this, and the national networks, cable networks, or consumer direct content producers take that content and advertisements and sell it to distributors in exchange for licensing fees. So when we look at the distribution column here, there are four main ways that distribution of content takes place today. The first is via traditional cable. So if you have a Comcast cable bill that you pay on a monthly basis that gives you access to channels, often the national networks are providing national programming to that cable service as well as national ads. The second would be satellite, and that would be something like Dish or DirecTV. And the third would be telecom, which I believe AT&T has a telecom service currently. So these are the more traditional methods that we're familiar with that have kind of dominated the market until very recently, when this fourth distribution method, which is internet-based distribution, has really gained steam. And so in the past several years, we've seen an increase in streaming, especially in the home, the ease of accessing content via internet. And so now there are many internet distribution mechanisms. So for example, this would be something like Netflix or Hulu or Discovery Go, I think is one, Disney Plus, anything that you're watching directly from the content producer via the internet. And so then finally, the last column here is the end user. And the end user of this information or of the content is the viewer. So whoever is consuming this information, they are paying subscription fees typically to either the cable, satellite, or telecom companies, or to individual direct-to-consumer companies who then license that content from the content producers. So all of this is to say that this industry has changed a lot since Oregon began taxing interstate broadcasters in an industry-specific manner, which was back in 1989. And so part of the history around this bill is trying to update statute to reflect issues that have arisen as a result of industry development over time. Okay, so two key details that have come up in the past regarding this topic, and I should mention that LRO has done, I believe, a few research reports between the year 2014 and 2019. The 2019 report was the most complete for reasons I'll describe, but these are two key questions that have come up throughout the discussion of this topic, and also related to a number of court cases that were in ongoing litigation during that time period. So the first here is, who is an interstate broadcaster? I put the statutory definition of broadcasting below this graphic. If you are engaged in broadcasting in Oregon, that means you are engaging in the activity of transmitting any one-way electronic signal for the purposes of communication. And so, as you can see, or as you might be thinking, currently this is very broad. This is a broad definition. In 1989, when the definition was created, this was much more narrow, I think, in scope of what this could be applied to. And so in the history of this this policy concept being developed to get to where we are today, there were a lot of questions about, okay, which taxpayers were broadcasters and why? So that was one question. And the current statutory definition, like I said, is listed there. And then the second key question that came up in many court cases as well as LRO's continued study, was which income of a broadcaster is apportioned. So I can get into the background of this if necessary, but it can get pretty far into the weeds. So I'll leave that as an option rather than forcing you to go through it. But essentially, current law says that any income other than tangible personal property and real property that a broadcaster has is subject to apportionment within the state. Okay, now on this next slide, I've again listed this one-way definition of broadcasting. One of the findings of our 2019 report was that this definition is narrow in scope, it is not narrow in scope. And so this could be an area where the committee might need to revisit this in future policy discussions if technology continues to change. And kind of the bottom line question here for the committee is, what is the policy intent in today's environment, given that we're seeing more direct-to-consumer and internet-based broadcasting? How do we want to tax, as a state, how does Oregon want to tax broadcasters? Now, to give you a brief history of the policy, and I've tried to just show this kind of conceptually.
When was the definition set in statute, or when was that any one-way electronic signal put into statute? Do you know that?
Yes, Chair Reschke, the one-way electronic signal was first put into statute for broadcasters in 1989.
So it's aged well, but may need to be revisited. Okay, thank you.
Sure. So showing the kind of policy history behind this, in the years leading up to 2014, when the state took a different policy approach related to broadcaster taxation, prior to that, so 1989 to 2013, Oregon used what's called the audience method of apportionment. And in the simplest terms, this means that we would apportion your income to Oregon using the ratio of your Oregon audience to your national audience. So whatever percentage that is, whatever percentage Oregon viewers make up of your total audience, you would apply that to your income, and that income would be sourced to Oregon in that manner. Now, problems arise when it is difficult, or there are differences in how the Department of Revenue and industry would calculate audience. And this could be due to differences in understanding regarding who the audience is between the department and the MPA, which stands for the Motion Picture Association. It can also be due to data availability issues that have come up in some of the court cases as well. So the key takeaway here is that at the time, DOR believed that the liability based on their view of the audience method of apportionment of these interstate broadcasters, the tax liability was much higher, and that's shown by this dotted blue line that's high up on the graph, than the MPA did. So based on their information and how they were interpreting the audience method, they believed their tax liability was much lower, shown by the dotted green line. And so as a result of this discrepancy, on a temporary basis, the committee decided to change to what was called the commercial domicile method of apportionment. And this is something that a number of states use to apportion income to income for broadcasters to their state. Now, remember, I talked about the audience method initially. This would be an alternative to the audience method. And this says that wherever we will source our income to the state based on the location or the commercial domicile of our direct customer. So if I'm a broadcaster and my direct customer is not the consumer, but the distributor, for example. So let's say that I am selling or licensing, content to someone like Comcast or Dish, then wherever that company is headquartered, wherever their commercial domicile is, the sales are sourced to the state in which they are headquartered. So this is a different policy approach than the audience method. Now, in the case of direct to consumer, this becomes a little bit simpler because if I am, let's say I am Netflix, and so I am selling directly to consumers, I don't have a distributor, and I know where my consumer's located, for my bill, my Netflix bill, for example, that sale would be sourced to Oregon. So this is a different policy, and this was adopted on a temporary basis while there was a request for LRO to do some reporting. The reason that it took this temporary provision was in place so long has to do with that ongoing analysis, as well as court cases that were moving through the legal system, which took a lot of time during this time period. And so that temporary provision was extended through 2019. Then as a result of the 2019 LRO study, this is an estimated $10 million average annual decline from changing from the audience method to commercial domicile. This is an estimate based on data we've received, I believe, starting in 2014. And that has to do with, again, some of these differences in understanding and the court case decisions coming in. So current law, where are we today? As of 2020, we're back at the audience method of apportionment, and this is because the temporary provision that I described of commercial domicile has expired. That was only in effect through 2019. So current law, if the committee were to not pass Senate Bill 136, or if for some reason it didn't go through, then we would be at the audience method. Now, there are some issues in terms of clarity with the audience method that stakeholders have raised, and that's where Senate Bill 136 comes in. So in Senate Bill 136, there's a slight revenue decline relative to the audience method of apportionment, which I'll describe in a later slide. But the big takeaway here is that Senate Bill 136 is the result of many conversations between the Motion Picture Association, LRO, and the Department of Revenue, aimed at trying to address some of the concerns or issues in implementing the audience method as is. And quickly on this slide, the main, I would say, changes from this bill relate to this increased use of consumer direct content production.
Ms. Harger, we have a question. Rep. Pham.
Thank you so much, Shereshki. Yes, Kate, Ms. Harger, I had a question about, could you go to that slide right before, the slide before that too? For SB 136A, it looks like the revenue is going to be going down. Is it kind of a linear process, or is it just going to kind of stabilize and plateau after 2021 at that level? Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Sure. And I'll actually go ahead to the slide that talks about this in depth, and I can return. But there's a slight decline based on moving from the audience method. So if in 2020 we're comparing audience method to this method, we're looking at about a $600,000 decline. And then from there, like if I were to do the revenue impact in 2021, that would already be current law. And so we wouldn't have that same comparison. So I would expect it to decline to this amount and then stay until there are other revenue changes. Does that?
Okay, so it would plateau.
Yes, essentially, when the law changes, you would see almost like a jump down in the graph. And then if we were tracking revenue moving forward, we would expect it to be around the same amount. Of course, it could increase or decrease based on changes in the market. But I wouldn't expect it to continually decrease by this much every year.
Great. Thank you very much.
Sorry, by that much additional each year. It should decrease by this amount and then plateau.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, thank you. So as I mentioned, current law is the audience method. That's what's used as baseline for our revenue impact analysis. The main focus I want to bring the committee's attention to is on the bottom of the slide, where it talks about policy. So what happens in Senate Bill 136A? Effectively, it changes the apportionment method, but only for some receipts. So one example that comes up often in testimony and highlights the need for this change is when a network or a content producer, so I've produced some content for television and I license it to a distributor. For example, let's say I license it to Netflix and then Netflix provides it to its subscribers. An issue comes up when the content creator is trying to source sales to Oregon or to any state, and Netflix will not let them know how many of their viewers are in Oregon, for example. So we're talking about the taxpayer being the national network or the cable network, whoever the content producer is. They are working through a distributor to get to their audience, which is important for the audience method here. But because the distributor views their audience as proprietary information, so like trade secrets, they don't want to share that with a competitor who would be the content producer. This kind of situation, which is becoming more common in this industry, is what the bill is aimed at addressing in the simplest sense. And so on the next slide here, I've listed section by section where the changes take place. As you can see by the bolded amounts here, most of the changes to statute occur in section 2. It describes apportionment methods for broadcasters. And this also is retroactive to January 1, 2020. So even though we're in 2021, because the temporary provision ended in 19, the bill as drafted applies to 2020. And just at the bottom of this slide, for time purposes, I'll take you through the main changes in Senate Bill 136. This directs the taxpayer to use the 0.6% as the numerator in their apportionment ratio. So it's providing a percentage for them to use only in the case of licensing to or advertising on subscription services when they do not have that information on their audience. So for example, if the audience information is considered proprietary, like in the example that I discussed before, then statute provides for an explicit use of this 0.6% in the numerator. So again, the goal is to try to address the situations where information might not be completely available to the taxpayer. That's one way that the bill does this. It also still provides an option to apply the audience method to all receipts. So one change the bill makes is to allow the audience method to be applied only to broadcasting sales. In current law, the audience method is applied to all sales of an interstate broadcaster other than tangible personal property and real property. So it allows for an option to opt in to what current law is. And then I showed this slide briefly, but essentially this is the revenue impact broken out by section of the bill. By applying the audience method to broadcasting sales only, This is market-based sourcing. Otherwise, that's one bill or one change, excuse me, that the bill makes. That's a slight revenue decline. And then using the 0.6 percentage in the numerator of the sales factor or of the apportionment factor, that corresponds to this negative 0.4 million decline. So I know that's been a lot of information early in the morning for most of you. Happy to answer any questions or provide any additional information that would help the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Harger. We do have a question. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Rushke. Caitlin, you may have addressed it and I missed it, but where does the 0.6 come from? What's that derived from?
So Chair Rushke and Representative Marsh, the 0.6, are you talking about in the bill?
Uh-huh.
Yes. So that came from an agreement between the Motion Picture Association and DOR in negotiations. Essentially, the idea was we don't have the information to calculate this on our end as the taxpayer, so we're going to throw out some numbers as a starting point. And I believe they're both in the room as well during the public hearing. They might be able to provide some more context as to how that relates to their books. But the 0.6, I would say, doesn't have any specific meaning other than it seems like a reasonable number based on those agreements between the Department of Revenue and the Motion Picture Association.
Chair Rushke, follow up. So there's no, it's just a negotiated number. There's no, it's not derived from or associated with any other factor.
So Chair Rushke, Representative Marsh, I believe Melissa Patak, who is on the line with the Motion Picture Association, I believe it's the starting point for that just negotiation or discussion was based on some of the information from their books, from the books of the MPA members. So hopefully she can shed a little bit more light on that. But it's not something that LRO developed from information that we had about any of those factors, if that makes sense.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just really, really want to compliment our legislative revenue folks. I think this is the fifth time I've been through this conversation, and the light finally turned on. So I just really want to compliment the team. This is such a complicated issue, and I think I really have my arms around what's going on now. So thank you, team.
Very good. Committee, any other questions for Ms. Harger? If not, we'll go to the witness list. And first up is Melissa Patak from the Motion Picture Association. Ms. Patak, please begin.
Thank you very much, Chair Rushke, Vice Chair Pham, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about this bill. Thank you for your consideration of this legislation. I spoke before you in early February about the House version, HB, I think it was 2455. So I'm not going to repeat that testimony, and Ms. Harger has done an excellent and outstanding job in explaining the bill. This has been an arduous path, a long path. We are really satisfied and pleased that we're on track to enact this legislation. It is a compromise. Representative Marsh, to answer your question, the audience method, it creates a lot of uncertainty. The audience means that for the comedy, you know, Comedy Central, you're trying to determine how many Oregonians are watching Comedy Central, how many are watching ABC, how many are watching sci-fi. And it's an arduous process. And the broadcasters have information that they believe, you know, demonstrates their audience. Sometimes that's in dispute with DOR. So the 0.6 is there was a negotiation. We obviously came in with a lower number. DOR came in with a higher, you know, to create some certainty as an alternate method. When the audience information was not easily ascertainable in the books and records. And as Ms. Harger pointed out, for some of the networks, the distributors don't provide that information about who's the Oregon audience. And so it's just unknown to the taxpayer, to the cable network. And so this is a compromise on a fair, reasonable, and predictable amount, both for the taxpayer and for Oregon. So that's really where it comes from. So anyway, we're in support of the bill. We thank you for all the attention you have given to this issue this year and in previous years, and we are hopeful for getting to the finish line on this legislation. And I'm happy to answer any other questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Marjorie Taylor from the Department of Revenue.
Vice Chair Rushke, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Marjorie Taylor, Legislative Director for the Department of Revenue. As Melissa acknowledged, we were last in front of you with the public hearing on House Bill 2455, which is identical to what was the original version of 136. At that time, we acknowledged that the agency would be able to implement the bill as drafted. However, that we were taking some additional time to review the provisions of the measure. We identified some issues that we wanted to resolve, and we're happy to engage with Legislative Revenue and through them to the MPA, and that's where we come with the A and Gross version of Senate Bill 136. And I have Joe Royston with me, who can help explain the provisions of the amendment that were ultimately approved by the Senate Committee in the bill before you. Thank you.
Well, let's hear from Joe then. Joy Royston from Department of Revenue.
Chair Rushke, Vice Chair Pham, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Joseph Royston. I am the manager of the corporation and estate section of the Department of Revenue. Certainly with the A engrossed version, we feel that it adds clarity in prescribing the contents of the sales factor for the taxpayer with broadcaster sales. The changes will simplify department administration and provide clarity for taxpayers. So we certainly have appreciated the conversations with the MPA, broadcasters, and LRO to ensure that the language in the bill truly reflects the intent of the legislature. So as we move forward, the department will certainly seek out input from MPA and other broadcasters during any rulemaking required. But really, we do believe that these amendments are beneficial for providing further clarification. Thank you.
Very good. Committee, any questions for our three witnesses? LRO, do you have anything else to add before we close the public hearing?
I do not. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 136 and opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 119. LRO.
Okay, good morning, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 119, this is a bill that was introduced at the request of the Department of Revenue, and it's relating to an existing tax subtraction that Oregon has on the books right now. And the existing tax subtraction that we have is related to artists when they make a charitable contribution of their own artwork. So what's in statute right now, what's allowed right now is a subtraction, which is basically equivalent to, you can think of it as like an itemized deduction, is an artist that makes a donation of their own artwork to a charitable organization can subtract the value of that artwork from their taxable income. And so that's on the books right now here in Oregon. The change in Senate Bill 119 is current law. When an artist makes this charitable contribution and they file their taxes, they must include an appraisal of the art piece. And that appraisal determines the value of the artwork in terms of what they can then deduct or subtract from their taxable income. Now, that appraisal requirement will still exist, but what Senate Bill 119 does is it changes their appraisal being required to be submitted with the artist's tax return. They would no longer be required to submit the appraisal with their tax return when they send their tax return in. They would still have to get the appraisal, and they still have to keep it for their records, but they wouldn't have to submit it with their tax return. So again, that's the change in Senate Bill 119 is really just relating to the submission of that appraisal report. And I believe Department of Revenue is here. They can explain a little bit more why they are making this, why this was requested, this bill on their behalf.
OK, committee, do we have any questions for Mr. Easton? All right, then we'll go to our first and only witness, Ms. Taylor with the Department of Revenue.
Chair Rushke, members of the committee, for the record, again, I'm Marjorie Taylor, Legislative Director for the Department of Revenue. Certainly appreciate Kyle's explanation of this measure. And ultimately, this is taxpayer-friendly, and it acknowledges that approximately 90% of our taxpayers are filing electronically. So although the statute will remain that the artists will have to get an appraisal of their artwork that they're donating for charitable causes, they don't have to submit that appraisal for their tax filing, but just retain it in the event that there's an audit in the future. And again, this is just taxpayer friendly and acknowledges that people are filing electronically more than they have in the past. Appreciate your support for the measure.
Committee, any questions for Ms. Taylor? Seeing none, I just will comment that I think that this is a common sense bill, actually. I mean, it makes sense not to have to, if you file electronically and then have to provide additional paperwork just to hold on to it. So very good. Again, committee, any questions? Representative Levy.
No, I don't have any questions. I don't have my hand up, do I?
Oh, I thought I saw you with your hand up. So maybe you were scratching your head. So there we go.
Could be.
All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 119. Works at LRO. Would you give us a brief summary of this bill again.
Mr. Chair, you were cutting out a little bit. Which bill did you open up? I'm sorry.
I closed House Senate Bill 119, and I opened a work session for discussion purposes only on House Bill 2453.
Thank you.
LRO.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. And yeah, House Bill 2453, the committee heard this originally back on February 1st. This is a bill relating to one of the 11 tax credits that are up for sunset review, one of the standard of the 11 tax credits that are up. And this one is a tax credit for the Oregon Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association. So again, just to kind of refresh everybody's memories, this is a tax credit when a health or life insurer becomes insolvent, the remaining insurers in the state basically can pick up some of those costs from that insolvency of the insurer that became insolvent. So the costs get spread throughout the insurers in Oregon, and then those insurers that are remaining still in the marketplace can receive a credit up to the cost of this assessment for the insolvent insurer. And so the credit is taken over 5 years, split into 20% increments. So it helps to offset those costs of that insolvency that's then spread throughout the other remaining insurers. And that's sort of the purpose of the credit, as it were. In terms of the paperwork on this, you will find, we do have a revenue impact statement that is up in the meeting materials to give you a sense. In most years, there is not an insolvency. It's actually pretty rare. There's also materials from our tax credit report as well that provide some background information. That's in the meeting materials as well. But these are pretty rare instances. So in recent years, we did have Penn Treaty became insolvent a number of years ago. So we have seen this credit increase. We would expect it to do so for a couple more years. We'll be seeing some use of this credit, and that's reflected, or a couple more biennium is reflected in the revenue impact statement as well. And then again, assuming another insolvency doesn't occur for another number of years, you would probably see the cost of this credit going back down to near zero, where it usually sits until another insolvency occurs, and then it ramps back up for a few years and then ramps back down.
Thank you, Mr. Easton. Committee, do you have any questions or discussion? Maybe we should have revenue every morning instead of afternoon, because everybody's nice and quiet. All right. Thank you, Mr. Easton. I'm going to close the work bill. Oh, what was that, Representative Levy?
I said, we just don't want to give you a bad time.
Thank you. I appreciate that, especially this morning. So any other comments? I see none. So I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2453 and open up a work session for discussion purposes only on House Bill 2737. And LRO, will you give us a summary of the bill?
Yes, Mr. Vice Chair. Once again, House Bill 2737, this was originally heard back on March 23rd in the committee, the public hearing, and it's creating a new personal income tax subtraction. In this case, it would be related to AmeriCorps National Service Education Awards. So when a taxpayer receives one of these education awards, as of right now, these are considered taxable income and subject to taxation. What House Bill 2737 would do is it would allow the taxpayer to subtract the amount of that education award from their taxation, making it non-taxable here in Oregon. The amount of the award would no longer be subject to taxation. So the committee heard, again, public hearing back on 3/23 on some of the potential impact that could be the effect for these taxpayers that are receiving these awards.
Committee, any questions or discussion? Mr. Easton, I have a question. Do we know what the expenditure is on this new subtraction?
Yeah, Mr. Vice Chair, that is one of the things we're still working through. It kind of putting the fine detailed numbers on this. It's looking at probably between $100,000 to $200,000. One of the things we're looking at in terms of the reporting for, this was the 2019 year, there was about 870 participants that completed and received an education scholarship award of about $3 million. What the process we're going through right now is just looking at, there are a couple other states that already have a similar policy in place right now. Iowa and Minnesota are the ones that come to mind. To give us a better sense of, while we know 871 qualified for these awards, not all of these individuals will necessarily use these awards for higher education or for repaying past tuition and fee expenses. So it's just a matter of trying to fine-tune that estimate. But again, it's looking, it's going to be between 100 and 200,000 per year is our expectation right now. But we'll know a little bit more after we sift through the details of Minnesota and Iowa as well.
Thank you. Committee, any further questions or discussion on House Bill 2737? Seeing none, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2730. Mr. Alanak, do we have another business on our agenda this morning?
No, Mr. Chair, you've completed the agenda for today.
All right. Well, thank you, committee members, and we are adjourned.